From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is DNA. I'm Frances Anderton.
Could it be that he's in something related, such as design or architecture?
Design.
Architecture.
Design.
Architecture.
DNA.
So Apple has bought Beats Electronics for $3 billion. And what did they buy exactly? A lot of style, for starters. On this show, we'll hear from the designers who helped make the company's image.
I drew a single curved line from one ear to the other, right? An arc. And that's how the original product was born, is this notion of this very simple, singular surface that ran from one side of the head to the other.
That's Robert Brunner, longtime chief designer for Beats. More from him later. We'll also hear from LA architect Barbara Bester, designer of Beats' new office in Culver City. But having just moved in, will the company be moving out to Cupertino? Since the announcement of the Apple Beats deal, tech watchers have been scratching their heads over why. They were hoping Apple would fill in the blanks at their Worldwide Developers Conference this past Monday. And did they? To find out, I turned to Bianca Bosca. She's executive tech editor of the Huffington Post and author of Original Copies.
Well, there was a very small cameo by Dr. Dre, who was patched in to show off a call feature that Apple announced. But other than that, we didn't hear a whole lot about Beats. You know, actually, Apple, if anything, stressed some new, not stress, but, you know, if anything, Apple showed off some new ways to actually buy and download music from iTunes more easily than before, which kind of runs counter to the whole logic that people have put together for the deal, which is this idea of switching to streaming music as opposed to downloads. Actually, surprisingly, Apple was pretty mum on the whole Beats acquisition. They definitely did, though, take some time to show off their new corporate recruit, who is Dr. Dre.
Now, Bianca, the last time you were on DNA, you were talking about Google Glass. And So it is to you that I should direct the question about one of the hypotheses, though, behind this deal, which was floated, has been floated in various stories, which is that actually the reason why they wanted Beats has to do with Apple wanting to put sensors into headphones and turn headphones into smart wearable technology. You're an expert on smart wearable technology. Does this notion sound plausible to you?
Well, I think, you know, if we look at the rationale for the deal, it's not just about smart sensors and headphones. I think the big picture idea here is it's about smart people in Apple. So I think this is more of a play to get really smart, influential people who have a taste for the intersection of tech and culture. Apple has always sort of talked about itself as this company that understands technology and the liberal arts. And so I see the Beats deal as partially a play to get a streaming service, partially a play to get some much-loved headphones, but really it's a pizzazz purchase. I mean, this is about bringing people who have their thumb and they have the pulse for the music industry. They understand what the mainstream audience wants, and they're able to bring a real sense of taste and culture into Apple. You know, if you look at the broad scheme of things, I mean, bringing in Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine follows in a string of hires by Apple, pulling from people in the world of fashion far beyond technology. You know, you had the CEO of Burberry, the former CEO of Yves Saint Laurent. You had people from Nike coming in. So it's really filling up its ranks with these individuals who don't just know how to build good laptops, but really understand, you know, what makes people pay extra for a device, what gets people hooked. And of course, who better to really do that than two music executives who've produced no shortage of incredible number one hits.
So does this suggest deference for Los Angeles from Silicon Valley?
I think it's a good question. I know you would love to have me say yes. I mean, I have to say maybe it's a deference to New York over Silicon Valley. No, but I think that in a sense, yeah. You know, Apple has always been a company that's succeeded by getting the tastes not of the early adopters, but of adopters. Period. Right? It's a company that goes after the students, the musicians, the artists, the mothers, the, you know, senior citizens, and doesn't just try and get the kind of developer crowd on its side. And so in that sense, yeah, I think that these are people that understand, again, what the mainstream audience wants. And so I can see Apple trying to bring in their brain power to figure out how they make a new future generation of devices as addictive as the ones they've already created.
So what about the other developments?
You know, what we saw from Apple was a company focused on tweaks rather than ta-das. What we saw was Apple software getting a lot of the features and tools that we've already seen on other products. There were little hints of Snapchat being copied by Apple's iMessage, or, you know, typing improvements that have existed on Android Google software for a long, long time. It's not to say that the next press conference won't hold something magical and revolutionary from Apple, but it's about time. The marketplace gets very bored. I think we've been used to being very wowed by what Apple has to offer. So, you know, yes, I think that they still can do it. I think that hiring talented people, be it from Beats or Burberry, is a great way to going about ensuring that they can continue to innovate. Have they delivered on that? You know, I think they have in the past, and I think we all hope that it'll be around the corner again soon.
What's really fascinating about everything you've just said is that this notion of, you know, we get bored so quickly. It's like there's got to be a new product. And if there's not a new product within 6 months, you know, Apple has just let us down. And it's like this crazy breakneck speed at which we expect sort of new ta-da products. When in fact, we're living in a time of the most incredible technological change, it seems.
We like instant gratification. I think, you know, the internet has gotten us hooked on always having some new delicious morsel to snack on. And, you know, once we get tired of it, there is something new. I think what's interesting, perhaps, is we're seeing our expectations of software and social networking applied to hardware, which is, of course, a bigger, more difficult challenge. So if you look at, for example, social media, I mean, we do have a new entertaining diversion every 6 months, you know, whether it's Snapchat or Secret or Whisper or you know, Instagram back in the day. There really is always something new to attract us and hold our attention. On the other hand, though, when you're talking about a smartwatch or an entirely new cell phone, those require much longer development cycles. We're talking about changing the way you manufacture products, shipping it around the world, changing materials. And so I think, you know, I wonder if we have a bit of a shortened attention span created by technology for technology itself.
When you refer to Instagram as being back in the day, I think you've proved your own point. Well, Bianca Bosca, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bianca Bosca is executive tech editor of the Huffington Post, and she's author of the book Original Copies, Architectural Mimicry in Contemporary China. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. In all the talk surrounding the Apple Beats deal, people do seem to agree on one thing. Apple has purchased that elusive thing called cool, namely the headphones that have achieved the same must-have factor as Apple products themselves, not to mention from some the same criticism: high design, high price. But behind those cool headphones lies a person, specifically Robert Brunner, founder and head of Ammunition Design and Branding Company in San Francisco, and chief designer for Beats since Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre founded the company. Now Ammunition will be ceding the branding to Apple, a bittersweet transition for Robert Brunner, especially as he was once chief designer at Apple himself, and he was responsible for hiring its now famed designer, Jonathan Ive. Robert couldn't speak directly about the transition, but he said,
Apple is arguably the most successful design-oriented company of our time, and for them to purchase a company which we have been developing the products for, of course, it's a huge validation of the value we've created with that work.
And how did it start, this relationship?
Well, I first met Jimmy and Dre back, you know, probably was in 2006, and met with them down in their offices at Interscope Records. And at the time, you know, they really just wanted to create a product. And it was really around Jimmy and Dre's passion about sound, and that, you know, they felt, you know, Dre is as an artist and a producer, is a perfectionist. I mean, he will spend, you know, sometimes a year creating a single song, and he felt like, I invest all this in my music, and then it goes out, and kids listen to it through inexpensive earbuds and, you know, through a compressed format, and they're not hearing my music. They're not hearing what I put into it and the emotion. And Jimmy really shared that passion and felt that it was, you know, almost a catastrophe that, you know, potentially losing a generation to sound. And he also saw this, you know, gap in out in the world of a high-performance audio product for his audience. And so that was really sort of the genesis of it.
And the sound piece is, of course, really fascinating because you know that there are audiophiles out there that criticize Beats headphones, and yet they are sold to millions, mm-hmm. and they love the sound. So what was it that was specific to Dr. Dre's sort of sound desires that separated those aims from, say, what an audiophile might want to hear from a Beethoven symphony on Bose headphones?
Well, it's not about audiophiles and what they want to hear. It's about Jimmy and Dre's audience and the music that they created. You know, the thing that I used to say is that the real secret weapon was Dre's and Jimmy's ears, because they created, you know, much of the popular music out there, and they know exactly how it's supposed to sound. You know, they created it. They know exactly how it's supposed to sound. So, you know, really it wasn't about pleasing audiophiles. It was creating music the way it was intended to be played, right? And putting it out in a way that captured that emotion in detail and in the integrity of the original sound. You know, the first products were decidedly bass heavy for a reason. And, you know, that was criticized. And again, for certain types of music, that may not be right. But again, it was about reproducing that sound. What we've actually done over time, and as through the latest products, is really balance that sound out. It's still geared towards the genre of music that the audience is listening to, but it is much more balanced and much more nuanced than the early products.
So when you first sort of sat down with them and started to imagine these headphones, did they have a visual picture in mind?
No, not really. I mean, we followed, you know, a pretty normal process of talking about it and thinking and presenting a variety of ideas and talking about it more and sort of from that. The thing that was really amazing for me in working with Jimmy and Dre was their abilities to focus and make decisions. You know, normally, a lot of times we work in a client relationship, getting people to help us narrow down on a direction, you know, take several rounds, and you know, they want to research it and hem and haw. Where those guys were pretty much, when they saw what they thought it should be, they said, that one, let's do that one, right? And no focus groups, not just that one. And working with them has been great, because we just really, once we hit that idea, it's completely supported and just go and do it and make it happen.
And what they very quickly agreed upon was, let's see it. Well, there was a couple of moves in those headphones that immediately sort of singled them out from other headphones. Can you just describe those moves?
Well, when I was presented with the original design problem, I went out and looked at every headphone I could find, and I found this real consistent theme is that, although while there were some amazing pieces of design and engineering, they all tend to be driven from a very functional perspective and around, of course, audio performance, but also comfort and ergonomics, right? So what you ended up with were pretty articulated things, right? Because everybody's heads and ears are different, so you had a lot of adjustment points, right? So rotation points around the ear cups, extensions, pads, you know, and so you ended up with these sort of very bumpy, busy designs. I remember looking at a front-on view of an existing popular headphone, and I drew a single curved line from one ear to the other, right? An arc. And that's what I wanted to do, was sort of somehow clean all that up into a very simple, iconic shape and design that was much more clean, much more sophisticated, and ultimately more iconic, because it hadn't been done before. And then go back and work out all the technical and ergonomic requirements to make sure it worked properly, but really start with that sort of clean visual. And that's how the original product was born, is this notion of this very simple, singular surface that ran from one side of the head to the other.
And then the logo is on the earpieces themselves.
Yeah, that was, you know, I began to understand over time with Jimmy was that what he wanted to do was make the headphone the celebrity. So really having that identity front and center and an integral part of the design was really important, you know, as its recognizability, you know, on the street and with athletes and so forth. Then the other thing that we've done a lot is customs and special editions, which, again, is not a new idea, but the way it was done and really sort of connecting those custom versions and special editions with individuals and teams and so forth and really sort of promoting. You know, at first, to be honest, I didn't like it, right? You know, I'm being a designer and a bit of a purist. You don't really necessarily like applying things onto your creations, right, in a way. But I began to view in the product, I started to look at in an almost Warhol kind of way that it was a canvas, right? And it was a canvas that we could use for expression and a canvas we could use to identify with, you know, individuals and teams and so forth. And that became, you know, a big part of the product and you know, very successfully helped, again, build the consciousness for the brand.
And you did co-brandings, or they did co-brandings with people like Lady Gaga. And you've said also in your statement that you felt you learned a lot from the experience yourself that you developed as a designer. Is that the kind of thing that you really learned over these years, was sort of just how branding can go much, much further than pure design?
Yeah. But, you know, the other things that I really learned from working with Luke Wood there and working with Jimmy and Dre on really how you really think in that context and use design in a leadership way and really, you know, it's been, you know, an incredible growth experience for me, something I would never have gotten without such a deep relationship with these individuals.
And of course, back to your past, you were, of course, chief designer at Apple. And everybody knows it's become all part of the Apple mythology that you hired Jony Ive. And now, in a sort of ironic twist, you know, Apple has now bought Beats. What does Beats offer, would you say, in terms of a pointer in terms of what direction media companies might be going in? I mean, it's really a sort of fascinating company, the way it evolved and exploded in this short time.
Well, you know, when we start working with a company, any company, you know, what we try and do is identify what my business partner, Matt Rawlinson, refers to as their extraordinary assets, right? And, you know, we usually find out that an idea and money are not really extraordinary assets. Right? What tend to be are things like understanding and owning an audience, having an amazing distribution system, having a cadre of talent within the organization that knows how to do some things very well. I mean, those are the things that you sort of build upon to make great successful product strategies. And, you know, and when, you know, step back and look at what we started out with Beats, you know, was Dre's passion and experience and understanding of sound and what it should be like in a modern context, and Jimmy's understanding of an audience and knowing how to communicate and connect with that audience and move the cultural needle, right? Those were huge assets, and those are the things that they had that helped make this successful as we developed, you know, products, great products to work within that.
And lastly, your collaboration with Beats sort of helped grow Ammunition. Polaroid is one of your big new clients. What other clients do you have that you might, in whom you might see some of this same sort of creativity and excitement?
Well, we're working with a large number of early stage companies right now that are really exciting. And, you know, I think there's been this sort of industry phrase that I think is largely misunderstood called the Internet of Things, right? But it's really about what the coming connectivity of devices all around us and you know, working to understand, what we're working to understand is what's really meaningful in that. There's a lot of hype, right? Do I really need a connected toaster that scans my bread and tells me when it's done and so forth? I don't know, but
I'm desperate for it.
You are. Well, there you go. But I think what is happening and what we're working on to figure out is, you know, new and meaningful ways of changing the way we live through connectivity. And I think that's, you know, we've got a few companies, one startup we're deeply embedded with in particular, which, you know, it's not out yet, so I can't talk all about, but that's really exciting to us. And we've also been working with Adobe on developing hardware products. We just launched a new smart connected pen that really enables the iPad to become a drawing tool for professionals, not just for content consumption. And those kind of relationships are really exciting. And that's really what we've always done, whether it's with a startup or whether with an established company, is work with a group of individuals on creating something new. And, you know, we've done that with Square, done that with, you mentioned Polaroid, Adobe, Barnes & Noble. Yeah, Nook. You know, it's just that's what's consistently what our team of talent has become very good at. And that's the kind of things we'll continue to do. You know, it's been interesting going through this, what's occurring with Beats. But I think, you know, given what I mentioned earlier about the appetite for design and the understanding of how it can, in fact, make really great business, is made this an amazing time for our business, our studio.
That was Robert Brunner, head of Ammunition Design Company and longtime chief designer for Beats. You're listening to DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Now, another designer who's worked with Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine, and partner Luke Wood is LA architect Barbara Bester. She started designing office space for Beats 4 years ago when they had a staff of 16. Now, around 600 people have moved into new digs in converted warehouses in the Hayden Tract area of Culver City, looking onto Baldwin Hills. The Beats space is light, mostly white, with dashes of colour and splash like a brass staircase and a medieval library. Staffers work mostly in sunlit open plan areas. They share a large concourse, a cafe and meeting spaces in the heart of the building. Then there are high quality recording suites and private meeting rooms lined with blow up views of LA by renowned photographer Ewan Barn. The place doesn't scream hip-hop or Hollywood. Rather, it's a refined kind of cool, with oak floors and furniture by young modernist designers, but it's already buzzing with the life of a small town. But just as the company moved in, the news broke. Barbara joined me in the studio to talk about it. Welcome, Barbara Bester.
Thank you, Frances.
First of all, this must be a very intriguing time to be unveiling a new office for this company that's going through this extraordinary transition.
It was a pretty wild week, I would say, given I think the move-in day and the rumors of the sale were in the same week.
So was there confusion, bewilderment, jubilation, lots of drinking?
I think there was, well, according to the videos, there was some drinking. I think it was very exciting. I think it was unexpected for a lot of people. And so there was definitely bewilderment. But I think now there is a sort of sense of purpose.
Sense of purpose, even as there still seem to be a lot of questions surrounding sort of who's doing what where, and one's reading that Jimmy Iovine will actually become part of Apple staff. Let's just start by finding out, might the company be moving lock, stock and barrel up to Cupertino, or will most staffers be staying in LA?
People will be staying in LA. That's the idea, and that it'll actually sort of become a hub for Apple in the city. And it's what's interesting to me as an architect, it's a different kind of a hub than what we see coming up in Cupertino.
Talk about that.
Well, I think there is a general trend that I guess is parodied rather well right now in Silicon Valley of a kind of childlike work environment, almost kind of kindergarten for adults. And we really felt, and our clients wanted to make a workspace that was able to produce a great lifestyle for millennials and others who are living there, but somewhere where you could work for 12 hours, 13 hours a day, not that you have to, but where you could work long hours and not necessarily feel like you were, you know, trapped. And,
trapped by surfboards and
trapped in Toys R Us. So I guess the kinds of environments that we were making were maybe more what you would find in a contemporary urban condition now, like coffee shop, sort of shared computer space room that's, you know, beautiful tables and chairs that are kind of open-ended. All these different kinds of ways of working. Actually, a big thing for us too is a lot of the people working at Beats, because of how things are produced now internationally, were constantly traveling, and they were telling us that they did a lot of their work in these sort of lounge rooms that are, you know, often in airports or in hotels or all over China. There's these kind of large work lounges, and you end up there for 9 hours having a bunch of different meetings, but you're in couches and you're not necessarily sitting in formal boardrooms all the time or at a desk, obviously. So making things that were spaces like that, but also, you know, could be the lobby of a really great hotel. That was kind of our goal.
How did you get involved with the company, and who at the top did you work with most? Was Dr. Dre kind of very engaged with the design of his spaces?
Well, I was brought in through Luke Wood, who is the president of the company, and certainly met with Dre and with Jimmy many times over the last couple of years. But I think to some extent, the daily work of the office had been entrusted to Luke. And he was someone who had a very, very strong vision in terms of literally making Beats the best place to work in LA. Like, that was my brief, which was not a bad brief to get as an architect and very unusual. But and so in that sense, was really wanting to look at, like, what are the current tropes in technology workspace. We'd spent a lot of time in programming, just meeting with the different people from different departments and kind of hearing what they needed, trying to bring, make sure that elements of music business culture, which both Luke and Jimmy Andre had all come from. In fact, our original office space was right next door to Universal Music, where Interscope is housed. But how could we bring parts of the music business that were kind of they needed to bring along, like places to have, you know, famous people coming in and out for interviews or just even to get some free product, but also, you know, a gym that was amazing, a recording studio, lounge spaces. Those were all parts that were getting folded in. So they were sort of changing the definition of a technology company that way.
And you haven't finished building yet. No. There's still more coming.
There's more to do. But I think the big thing for us that was exciting was that the sort of crown jewel, like the headquarters project, was completed before this new Apple thing. So in a way, it's almost like a time mark, you know, and then the next phase of Beats, you know, is to be determined how that kind of collaboration goes, both architecturally and business-wise.
And one of these as yet unfinished pieces is the graphics that are going to be on the exterior of the building. Currently, as I understand it, there's going to be a B. Do we expect it to stay a B or will it become an A?
We don't know. We have a permit for a B. So we'll see what happens. We actually there's a graphic package. I mean, so much of our work in the building was these different kinds of graphic moments. But we were always really intentionally very minimal about branding the building inside and outside. There really aren't a ton of Bs. I think the best B that we have is this one carved in marble that's on the wall in the coffee shop area. But it was kind of an interesting project because for a company that has so much branding as it's coming out of its products, the goal really in the workspace wasn't to kind of keep hitting people over the head with that. It's really more of this humane environment or beautiful environment than it is a kind of big advertising or retail environment.
Well, Barbara Bester, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frances. It was very fun.
Barbara Bester is an architect, professor, and principal of her own firm, Bester Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. That's it for today's show, but before you leave, I just want to draw your attention to the Los Angeles Design Festival starting next week on June 13th. LA Design Festival is helmed by Michael Sylvester and Haley Zaki, and it's grown into a packed 3 weeks of tours, parties, and what they're describing as the first ever Design Hookie series. Basically, the Design Hookie concept means take Friday off work and go check out the wonders in our own backyard and meet their designers, among them architect Michael Maltzen and the Line Hotel's designer Sean Nibb. Design Hookie West and Design Hookie Center City are coming up later in the month. LA Design Festival has 5 pairs of tickets to give away to Design Hookie East. This will get you entry to all 3 parties and all 3 tours. Just write us at dna@kcrw.org and we'll give those pairs to the first 5 of you to respond. That's it for today's DNA. Thank you to Ray Guana, Caroline Chamberlain, and Jason Groman, our very own Jason Groman, who is currently in Las Vegas getting married. Congratulations, Jason and Selena. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.
I told my mother I was going to be a famous artist.
Design's a really loaded word.
Designing and building.
Postmodern stuff.
DNA.
Design.